Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We'll talk immigration for a little bit, some health care, a little mergers and acquisitions, and we will end with a dance party. Seriously. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 13th of November. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. There are still about 7 weeks until the new Congress gets sworn in, but I think it is safe to say, as winter settles over Washington, D.C., that the chill has already started. And based on a report in the New York Times today, things are only going to get frostier. The paper says that perhaps as soon as next week, President Obama will take executive action on immigration. Actions that will quite possibly have economic as well as political consequences. Michael Shear is a White House correspondent for The Times. He shared the byline on the story today. Michael, thanks for coming on.
Sure. Happy to be here.
In a nutshell, what's the president thinking about doing as far as you know?
The centerpiece of the program is something that would say, if you are here illegally but you have a child who is a citizen of America or who is a legal permanent resident, depending on how long you've been here, depending on if you've got a criminal record, there are some people that would be exempt, you would be able to apply for what they call deferred action. It would essentially put you to the side and say, we're not going to deport you. And it would also give you a work permit. You'd have legal papers. You could go into a place of employment and you'd be out of the shadows.
Which is an interesting proposition in an economy which is still facing a softish labor market.
Right. And so there are clearly people immediately that seized on this, Republican folks who jumped on this as a bad idea. That's going to be one of the criticisms. And, you know, another criticism obviously coming from part of the Republican Party will be that, you know, these folks have broken the laws of the United States and shouldn't be rewarded for that.
With the acknowledgement that you're the White House correspondent and not the labor correspondent for The New York Times, who do we think these workers are? What does that do to the labor pool in this country?
You know, there's a lot of folks, and I'm not a labor reporter, but I think there's a lot of people that would say, look, these folks are largely employed anyway, right? These are mostly people who have been living in the country for many years, 5, 10 years in some cases. They hold down jobs, but they're holding these jobs in a kind of a hidden way or in a way that they're constantly looking over their shoulders and having to be worried about, a deportation proceeding if they're caught. And so I think the idea that the administration puts forward anyway is that if you bring these folks out of the shadows in that respect, allow them to sort of hold these jobs in a kind of above board way, it actually helps the economy and doesn't hurt it.
Talk to me for a second about the politics of this thing. Obviously, the president waited until after the election to potentially do this as soon as next week. Republicans have some levers they can pull. There are budget negotiations coming up, for example.
Right. You know, there are some Republicans who want to insist that the budget reflects that the government will not spend any money on this and that the president's actions will be essentially undermined. You know, whether ultimately the Republicans are going to be willing to take that to its ultimate conclusion and threaten another government shutdown over this issue, I think is probably unlikely. The leadership of the Republican Party, notwithstanding some of the other members, really doesn't want to get into another fight like they had over Obamacare. And so, I think the president's people feel on pretty firm ground that they can pursue this without that being much of a threat.
Very quickly, a couple of other things in here. First of all, it would change the high-tech visa system, which is of interest, obviously, out in Silicon Valley, and it refocuses what 12,000 immigration enforcement agents do down on the border.
Right. So on the high-tech, the law requires that the Congress set the number of visas, but there's some they think there's some tweaking they can do within that law to give the high-tech industry a little bit more flexibility to be able to bring folks from abroad. And on the refocusing of the immigration agents by saying don't focus on all of these families, they can then tell those agents to focus more, for example, along the southern border, which, you know, everybody acknowledges needs to be more secure. And so that's essentially a sop to the Republicans saying, look, we'll shift some of these priorities to the border, and that'll help you guys as well.
Michael Shear is a White House correspondent for The New York Times. Michael, thanks very much.
Sure. Happy to do it.
A quick corporate update before we go on. Amazon and Hachette, the publishing company, have come to an agreement. Their extended and very high-profile contract dispute, which became a touchstone in the publishing world, ends with Hachette winning the right to set prices for the e-books that it publishes. Other than that, no details, as they say, were disclosed. Wall Street today was mostly a whole lot of bouncing around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lost in all the hullabaloo over the U.S.-China climate change agreement this week was a little thing that we like to call global trade. Two big deals got done. The first, also with China, cuts tariffs on things like semiconductors and a bunch of other high-tech stuff. The second, with India, cleared an impasse over food stockpiling that will, in turn, rejuvenate a trillion-dollar agreement on international customs procedures. Smack at the heart of them both, companies right here in the U.S. of A. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
We're talking about the WTO's Trade Facilitation Agreement and its Information Technology Agreement. Not the jazziest of names, but important deals. Derek Scissors, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, says because trade agreements have been stalled for years, this feels like a breakthrough.
And what's the common part here? The U.S.
Scissors says these deals restore American leadership in trade.
We're the ones breaking through the barriers. We're the ones making the deals. And with other important countries like China and India, but nonetheless, we're the common thread here. That's important.
And U.S. companies stand to benefit big time if the tech agreement is finalized, says Gary Huffbauer, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
You go through the companies that are big in this space, and a lot of them, say two-thirds of them, have U.S. names. You know, Apple, Cisco, you can go down the list.
Huffbauer says the key here isn't the number of jobs this agreement might create, but the type. Steady, high-skilled, with good pay. And to a lesser extent, companies that do lots of global shipping, like FedEx and UPS, might also benefit from the Trade Facilitation Agreement. Zooming out, these deals speak to how globally integrated our businesses have become, says Emily Blanchard, a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
In this world with global supply chains, little pieces of products are being added up all across borders to create a final product. If you have even small transaction costs at every border, those add up.
Blanchard says that's especially true when it comes to electronics. So both these trade deals are important steps. Of course, they haven't been finalized yet. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Warren Buffett's been doing a little bit of shopping of late. Today it was Duracell, the battery company that is getting spun off from Procter & Gamble. Buffett is paying the $4.7 billion asking price in stock, not Berkshire Hathaway stock, his holding company. He's paying it in Procter & Gamble stock, which I guess Berkshire just happened to have lying around. Nice to be a billionaire, I suppose. Berkshire Hathaway did a similar swap earlier this year when it bought a TV station from Graham Holdings, formerly and much better known as the Washington Post Company, and also same kind of deal when it bought a subsidiary of Phillips 66 last December. Now, why not just pay cash since interest rates are so low and cash is basically free? Marketplace's Dan Weissman explains the method behind the transactional madness.
First, these trades line up with something Berkshire Hathaway has come to like: owning and managing whole companies. Larry Cunningham is a law professor at George Washington University and the editor of The Essays of Warren Buffett. He says once, Berkshire was happy to either own stock, even a small stake or position, or a whole business. Now,
it prefers to own entire businesses rather than small positions. So this is a neat way to achieve that objective.
Also, these swaps allow Berkshire Hathaway to save a boatload on taxes. Procter & Gamble stock is worth a lot more than when Berkshire bought it. So selling that stock would mean paying taxes on the profit, probably more than 33%. Thomas Leese is a finance professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He's done the math. Selling the stock would give Berkshire a profit of
$4.4 billion. So a third of that, you know, is hefty tax.
However, Berkshire isn't selling the stock. It's trading one piece of Procter & Gamble, the stock, for another piece, Duracell. Going for big tax savings seems like it would sit uncomfortably with Buffett's personal role as the rich guy who's always calling on the government to change the tax code and raise his taxes. Leith says there's an important distinction.
Warren Buffett has an obligation to his shareholders, and that obligation is to pay as little as the code allows.
Buffett may think the code needs changing, but meanwhile, taking advantage of every loophole is his job. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Remember healthcare.gov? Yes, of course you do. The debacle that was its launch last year. Who could forget, right? The site gets put to a new test this weekend when open enrollment begins for year two of the Affordable Care Act, which runs tomorrow through February. Choosing your health insurance through that site, or through many others, is a long, long way from just being a plain old Google search. And that, my friends, is a business opportunity. From the Health Desk at WHYY, here's Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein.
Everybody knows shopping for insurance stinks. Not only do we not like it, but we're not very good at it. In the first year of the ACA, Minnesota State Exchange CEO Scott Leet says he saw consumers struggle.
In many, many cases, it was, you know, hours of time that were spent, you know, kind of walking a person through what their various choices were, answering their questions, and then helping them make a final decision.
With millions flocking to public exchanges under Obamacare, this shopping problem that researchers have known about for years is coming into focus. Coinsurance, deductibles, in-network, out-of-network. Figure that all out, then compare screen after screen of health insurance plans. On top of that, Wharton economist Jonathan Kolstad says you've got to guess what problems you'll have over the next 12 months.
Ultimately, insurance is not just about the world as we know it today. It's about where we're going down the road.
Add the future into the mix, and Kolstad says there are more than 900,000 variables to consider when shopping for health insurance. No wonder we tend to make such poor choices. Those choices, though, have real-world costs. Kolstad's research shows when employees don't know what they're doing, they can leave $1,800 on the table. There's an opportunity here, both to help people and to cash in.
We're frugal. We have inherited chairs.
We inherited all this furniture.
They're decomposed.
The only other new furniture is the IKEA furniture that we built.
We're in classic startup territory, a whole thrown together feeling, more desks than people, hinting of promise. Several University of Pennsylvania professors, including Kolstad and industry veteran Jay Silverstein, have launched Pickwell. It's software designed to help consumers to, well, pick well.
We essentially help make the process easier, simpler, faster, better.
Silverstein admits it's a bold claim, but says with just four magic questions.
What is your age? Where do you live? By zip code. What is your gender? What medications are you on?
Their algorithms cut, slice, and dice the answers with medical claims, credit scores, and more. The result is Google-like. Almost instantaneously, it spits out a list of the plans and ranks them, as well as total monthly costs, premium and out-of-pocket. Industry consultant Ted Von Glahn, who has no ties to the company, says Pickwell's taking a lot of the mystery out of the shopping.
The golden rule is do the math. Don't make me go find that, you know, neurologist procedure and is it covered or not. Bring it right to me.
Compare Pickwell's tool to healthcare.gov. The Federal Exchange, says Von Glahn, only offers the most basic, forcing consumers to still do the math. Pickwell is one of a dozen companies in this little consumer choice space, and Von Glahn believes as these products mature, it will force the entire industry, insurers, hospitals, and doctors, to become more efficient.
They can't compete on the mistakes that consumers make, the dazzle and confusion of choice.
PricewaterhouseCoopers says a third of private companies are considering moving their employees onto private exchanges within the next 3 years. Whether exchanges blow up or disintegrate could turn on the success of outfits like Pickwell. Silverstein says they've already lined up private and public exchanges, including Minnesota's. He says there's a good chance their clients will grow from 750,000 this year to 40 million in 2015.
Usually when we present, what we hear is silence and then a murmur. Am I allowed to say holy shit? And then we hear, we'd like to learn more. How can we talk? How can we use it? When can we get involved?
Pickwell executives believe the industry is moving towards a time when consumers can actually find value. That would be quite a transformation for a product that today many don't understand or trust at all. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The main role for a DJ to really have a great party is to have, you know, communication and chemistry with an audience in a club, just like a good performer does.
Good money in it, too. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. On a Thursday, the Dow Industrials ticked up 0.2%, 40 points, closed at 17,652. The NASDAQ up 0.1%, 5 points, 4680 there. The S&P 500 added less than 0.1%, a single point, finished at 2,039. Crude oil prices, Brent crude in this case, that's the European slash North Sea version, fell below $80 a barrel for the first time in 4 years as Chinese economic growth continued to slow. Oil company shares joined that slide. Marathon Oil off 2% today. Chevron down about 1%. Exxon unloaded 0.75%. Amazon and the French book publisher Hachette, as we told you, buried the... Yeah, no, I'm not going there. Ended their six-month feud, as you know, over ebook pricing. Amazon shares booked up 1.5%. Here's a stunner. I don't know the last time you heard me say this. BlackBerry shares up more than 8% today after the company announced a partnership with Samsung to use BlackBerry's security system on Samsung phones. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for October, and this has a lot to do with how much you may have spent. The University of Michigan releases its preliminary November consumer sentiment survey. And on November 14th, 1972, the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit a milestone, topping 1,000 for the first time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Eventually, I think everything in the entire world, media, entertainment, industrial goods, financial services, everything will be owned by one big, giant, worldwide conglomerate. I mean, if you play out the mergers and acquisitions game to its logical conclusion, that is kind of where it takes you, right? Today's Exhibit A is a report that the toy maker Hasbro is going to buy DreamWorks Animation. It would be the children's toy subdivision of the aforementioned big, giant, worldwide conglomerate, I suppose. Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
Once upon a time, toys were, well, just toys. You built stuff with Legos and played make-believe with Transformers. But that's all changed.
Look, this is not normal steel.
I don't think it's a truck at all. I think we just found a Transformer.
That's Mark Wahlberg in a preview for the latest Transformer movie. Hasbro makes Transformers and the Ouija board, which was also made into a movie. Chris Burns is a toy analyst at TTPM, and he says these days popular toys are considered entertainment properties.
Now it's like, how do we think about this property in all the ways in which kids encounter entertainment? So that could be toys, that could be TV, that could be movies, that could be video games.
The shift reflects the way kids are buying toys. Sean McGowan is an analyst at Needham, and he says it used to be toys and cartoons were about it when it came to children's entertainment, but today...
Claims on kids' time and attention and money are growing, so you see them using their smart devices.
McGowan says featuring toys as movie stars has helped, but overall toy sales have remained flat for more than a decade. Paul Sweeney is an analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, and he says also driving the trend, movie studios have grown bullish on featuring toys.
The studios are really looking for tried and true, already proven franchises, if you will, either stories or characters.
Sweeney says this deal would make sense on some levels, but he says the list of companies that have lost fortunes trying to make it in Hollywood is a long one. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Pop music nowadays is increasingly dominated by producers, the people who shape the sound of a recording. A lot of that sound is coming from the world of what is known as electronic dance music, or EDM, the working hours of which are not, shall we say, conventional.
I didn't get to bed too late last night. Last night was about 2:30. That's kind of average. Usually it's like 4 or 5.
That's a guy named Wesley Pence. He had a cup of coffee in front of him, some green juice thing, and a big glass of water when we talked. But if you're a fan of EDM, you know him better as Diplo. He's a DJ, a music producer, and he runs a record label. Thanks for coming in.
How you doing?
I'm good. I guess the first question I have is what to call you, Wesley Pence, Diplo, Major Lazer. I mean, you are out there under a variety of brand names.
I wear a lot of hats, but you can just call me, you can call me Diplo here, because that's the main artist that I come as.
How did you come up with that name?
This girl nicknamed me this when I was in high school, and it kind of stuck.
She nicknamed you Diplo?
It was Diplodocus. It's the short form of this dinosaur name. I'm still looking for a name. If someone wants to email me some new...
There you go. They can get to our Facebook page and
yeah, hit them on Facebook.
I wonder if we should describe for people what it looks like when you are up there in a club or wherever you are doing that DJ thing. Because it's almost... you got a computer, you got a bunch of keyboards, you've got some... you could be writing some weird, crazy computer code. It's kind of bizarre.
There's a lot going on. It could also look like you're just on your email. But I think the main role for a DJ to really have a great party is to have, you know, communication and chemistry with an audience in a club, just like a good performer does.
I want to hear some stuff you've done, and I want to go to the Major Lazer thing
let's
that
go.
We've got queued up. Let's hit it. It's a thing called Watch Out For This. So there's man, there's a lot in there. There's like Jamaican stuff. There's
some salsa.
Yeah, electronic beats in there. I mean, I know this is going to sound ridiculous.
Yeah.
If I walked into a club and I was a club aficionado, would I be able to tell that it was you?
I think my style, you can immediately hear my style. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I'm really eclectic. Where like that song you just played has references of house music, electronic music, salsa, reggae. Major Lazer is a mashup of all these kinds of things.
Talk to me for a second about being a guy who runs a record label in 2014.
Well, that means a lot of things because a small label like what we have at Mad Decent, that's my label's name, is difficult. We almost folded a couple of years ago. It's really hard to stay alive.
Yeah.
But and the music industry has changed a lot. We can find money in different places now. There's streaming revenue. There's a lot of publishing money when you get a sync or a license for a commercial or a video game, which happens a lot for us.
Oh, yeah.
And there's the touring aspects.
How much time do you spend on the business versus how much do you spend on the music?
You know, I hate being on email all day, like, right, you know, answering.
Welcome to my life,
it's crazy. But
I know.
I like wait for the weekends when no one emails me. I'm just traveling and I'm just working on, I'm working in hotel rooms and working on airplanes on music.
So where's the money then for you, right? Is it DJing? Is it touring with Major Lazer? Is it the label?
The label doesn't, I don't make any money from my record label.
All right, well then you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Well, the label does make income, but I've never really taken a salary. Uh-huh. I've actually released music on my label. A lot of money for me personally comes from my touring, you know, but the label I do make a lot of money from as an artist on the label. Funny enough, I'm also an artist. I'm Mad Decent. My releases come out. So I will take a check every quarter that's decent from the releases I put on my own label.
I want to hear another thing that you've produced. This isn't you. This is track you produced with MIA. It's called Paper Planes. Let's hear that, and I want to talk about producing music. I fly like paper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, I'll make a more day. I get one down in a second if you wait. All right, you know what? So
hey.
I like that better than I like your stuff.
Hey, that is my stuff, man. Technically.
So walk me through that. Somebody comes to you and says, hey, man, I want you to produce my record.
Well, you know.
How does that work? What happens?
That's one of the first records I ever produced that got big. It was a really strange record to get big, but it showed me that, like, there's some, maybe I'm doing something right. The background of the record is a Clash record. I love the Clash.
Yeah.
Even today, as for what I do with Major Lazer and this reggae hybrid stuff, they're one of my favorite groups to really break down boundaries and create music out of mixing things together.
I mean, that's the interesting part, right? This whole thing that you do in EDM and a lot of your stuff is the sampling of other stuff.
Yeah.
Just playing short snippets of it.
When you find a loop like that one we had from the Clash song, I would play it for like 30 minutes. I could hit a loop and it wouldn't get boring. So I developed a beat and a bass line around that because I knew it was an earworm. Like it would stick in your head.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know when you hear a record or another artist, do you have a gut thing? Yes, that's it. Or yeah, not for me.
I hope so. I mean, I hope that's a lot of times I've banked on records that didn't do well, though, you know. But I think that essentially we've had a good track record at the label with the artists that I produce. So I hope that's the one skill I have in the music industry.
Wesley Pence, Diplo, Major Lazer, Mad Decent is the label. Yeah. Thanks for coming to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Before he left, we asked him to put together a Mad Decent Marketplace playlist, one that speaks to our themes of money and business and the economy. You can check it out at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace file folder that is labeled Corporate Gobbledygook That Can't Possibly Be True, come on. We learned today that the CEO of Reddit, Ishan Wong, has stepped down, which is fine. CEOs leave all the time. Here, though, is the first sentence of the blog post in which the news was revealed, and I quote here, "Last week, Ishan Wong resigned from Reddit. The reason was a disagreement with the board about a new office," end quote. No mention of Wong's very public dispute with a Reddit employee last week or the company's struggles to capitalize on its enormous user base. But hey, at least it's better than he wanted to spend time with his family, right? All right, we're done. Today, the Dow up 0.2%. That's 40 points. The Nasdaq gained 0.1%, 5 points. The S&P 500 added less than 0.1%, a single point. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.